I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
We were so excited to be at the Cherry Bomb Jubilee on March 29th, 2015 to record the incredible panels. Cherry Bomb Jubilee was a day of celebration and conversation with some of the most inspiring women in the world of food. We'd like to share one of the panel recordings with you, this one titled Change the World, One Bite at a Time. The panel featured Tanya Holland, professional chef, cookbook author, and owner of Brown Sugar Kitchen and B-Side Barbecue in Oakland, Martha Hoover, restaurateur in Indianapolis, and Jordan Lexton, educator, thinker, and doer who founded Drive Change. The panel was moderated by Vivian Howard, chef owner of Chef and the Farmer in North Carolina. So let's jump right into the panel as Martha Hoover is explaining how she's found success opening her restaurants in the Indianapolis area.
But it actually turned out to be the reason, I believe, why we're so successful. And today, we just recently opened up my 11th restaurant in Indianapolis, Indiana. Yep. Ooh, thank you.
And how does Indianapolis play into that? Because, I have a restaurant in a small town that doesn't have a robust restaurant community. And I imagine when you opened in Indianapolis, it was the same scenario. Was that a challenge or a good thing?
Well, it was both a challenge and a good thing, but the fact that I opened up what is considered to be the first farm-to-table restaurant in Indiana at a time when that phrase didn't exist in the lexicon, and, what the kind of food that we were serving, how we were preparing it, and the ingredients that we were using, and the sourcing that we were conducting was very unheard of at the time. Now it's fairly commonplace. And yes, we were truly in a food desert of sorts regarding quality food. And it was shocking because Indiana is an agricultural state. So we grow some of the finest produce in the world. I'm not exaggerating. And it always amazed me that chefs and restaurateurs did not use the ingredients from our own backyard. So it really did, it was very compelling when I opened up the restaurant to use those items.
And Tanya, you are in Oakland, and you have roots here in the Southeast as well as New York. And so I'm curious as to why you chose to open Brown Sugar Kitchen in Oakland.
I always say to people, Oakland chose me, it happened very organically, but I moved to the Bay Area, I moved to San Francisco, then I tried Alameda, and I was working in Berkeley, and I kept driving through Oakland, and I just really felt the vibe of that city, plus I saw it as an opportunity. I didn't see, a vibrant restaurant scene at that time, and also it's a very historically African-American community. And I didn't see the food represented in the way that I wanted. I would have liked it, so I saw it as a great opportunity. And having lived in New York during the 80s, I just was able to visualize the potential of this city that was right across from the Bay, seeing what happened with Brooklyn and also what's happening in different parts of Manhattan that were, untapped back then. So I just, kind of looked at it that way.
As an opportunity.
Yeah.
And Jordan, you come to this from as you're an English teacher in a jail.
Yep.
with no restaurant experience to speak of. And I can understand your observation that people coming out of that facility had no real opportunities in front of them. And I can understand your urge to provide some, but why a food truck of all things?
A lot of real concrete reasons. So I was a teacher on Rikers Island for 3 years, from 2009 to 2012, and I saw the impact of the system on youth. There was a culinary arts class in one of the facilities, and it was really there that a lot of my students demonstrated self-worth and creativity that did not permeate the rest of the facility. I also have had the experience in my own life of having food as a source of community, as a source of education, cooking with my family, being connected. And I saw it as an industry where we could provide real jobs to young people coming home from jail and prison and also teach transferable skills. Now, a food truck adds the mobility. We wanted to be mobile. We wanted to be in other communities. We wanted to engage and connect. And there really is no back of the house on a food truck. So that moment of connection is so present and so important for the young people we employ and for our customers. It's also a lower overhead. So we were able to get in sooner rather than fundraising for a brick and mortar. Food trucks, I think, also are both of the moment, but really do represent this presence of social media and visual marketing that we thought could really contribute to our brand as well. So Drive Change was launched with those principles in mind, broadening awareness, letting people know. New York is actually one of two states that automatically arrest 16-year-olds as adults, and we try to let as many people know that as possible when we're serving them delicious food off of our Vendy award-winning food truck, Snow Day. But those are the concrete reasons. The mobility was so essential to what we were doing.
So I was going to point out that it's not just, you're not slinging street meat and boiled hot dogs. You're a Vendy award-winning food truck. And I'm very interested in the idea that you're taking folks with probably low self-esteem and not a whole lot of cooking skills and allowing them to achieve excellence. And how do you do that? Tanya, you do a lot of that in your business. You know, you spoke about, to me, just proximity, where you are. You end up hiring a lot of folks who are straight out of jail. And you both are doing excellent work. How do you take someone and show them what that is and show them how to get there?
Well, I think, you know, you have to lead by example. I always tell my employees, I'm not asking you to do anything that I wouldn't do or haven't done myself. And just, you know, recognize some of their limitations, and not just skill set, but in socialization. And just, you know, kind of, it's a constant education, and also educating the other people that they work with that, you know, they don't come from the same experience that you do, and, you know, just bringing everybody to the same page. It's a great common denominator, though, the restaurant industry. It's an equalizer.
Yeah. I think we've been hearing a lot also, too, about authenticity and the entrepreneurial spirit and culture. And, you know, what we've done this past year, we launched our first food truck business literally a year ago. And we hired 10 young people coming home from jail and prison to help us launch this business. And we've really all grown it all together. And I think that that level of touch, like the closeness of building a business and how entrepreneurialism can really invest in that sense of empowerment, you have real sense of ownership and honor when it comes to the product that you're serving. So, you know, I came to this with the criminal justice background. I decided to work on a food truck first to gain some practical experience myself. But then I also learned very quickly that criminal justice and poverty, like the food justice and criminal justice movement, are so intertwined. So I was able and fortunate enough to connect with fantastic people in the food space. My culinary arts director, who comes from a purveying background, has worked in the green markets for, you know, 10 years. And learning about sourcing products sensibly, really understanding the food system, has allowed us to create this holistic approach to our overall business, recognizing that those things are so interrelated.
Martha, I participate in running two restaurants with my husband, and we're a busy restaurant, but we still struggle to just make it. And from everything that I know about you and what your restaurant group does, you give so much back to your community. And I wonder how you're able to carve out that space to really pay attention to that and make it a priority.
Well, since 1989, giving has been part of the company's DNA. And, you know, once you start with that genetic pattern, you just keep growing it. And as the company has become more successful, as it's become larger, as we employ more people, as we make more money, we find that the pattern is that we give more. And what happened, and I don't think we've talked about this yet, but our 11th restaurant is a restaurant named Public Greens. It's on a city greenway, and it's associated with a micro farm that we also control and own. We have a dedicated farmer on our staff who helps us with all of our farming. But the thing that's so amazing about this restaurant, I think, besides the food is just incredible, but is truly that we have dedicated 100% of the profits to our foundation, the Potter Shoe Foundation. And I think that's really why I'm here today, why Carrie asked me to come, because it was a fairly radical move for a restaurant to do that. Our giving has always been very deep, but it has always been, up until now, relatively scattershot, as I think most corporate giving starts out. You know, there's so many good organizations, so many incredible not-for-profits, and so many needy causes that it's hard almost to say no to any of them. But what we found internally was that the money that we were spending as a company was not making the impact in any of the ways that we measure our impact. It wasn't making the impact on the community the way we wanted it to, because we didn't really know if the money that we were given was really being used for the end user. There's an old model of not-for-profits where so much money has to be raised and the levels of administration are so deep. We never really knew what was going on with the checks for $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 that we were writing, and it was a lot of money for us, so we were very upset about that. Secondly, there wasn't enough impact with our staff, and I was getting all the credit for writing checks, but I knew every time I wrote a check that if it weren't for the fact that I have pastry chefs who show up every morning at 3:30 and cooks that get in and start working really hard at 5 a.m. and et cetera, if it weren't for this really loyal bunch of employees of mine, I wouldn't be able to write those checks. So that bothered me a lot. And then it bothered me a lot that our giving did not tell the story of the company enough to make an impact on our customers. And when you do something from a business perspective, it has to make sense for the business. So being the control freak that I am, I decided to halt everything and to start our own foundation. And the foundation was started about the same time you started your food truck. And we feed after-school whole nutrition, very incredible ingredient-laced meals that our staff makes and delivers to children in our community who suffer from daily food insecurity. And since its inception, we have fed approximately 7,500 meals in about a year, so I'm very proud of that. Thank you.
You know, I don't think that Oakland is necessarily quite the same as Kinston, but it is a community with a lot of needs. And we find that every single day we get between, you know, 3 and 10 inquiries for, can you give us a gift card? My daughter's going to be in a beauty pageant. Can you sponsor her? You know.
Yes, I do know that. Yeah. I'm not the Oakland person, but we got that. We get that too.
Yes. So, you know, we are in this place where we really want to give back and participate, but do so in a meaningful way. And it seems as if you've figured that out. But if you're running like a, you know, a single or double unit operation, how can you give back in a way that makes sense and makes an impact? And I wonder if you have anything you'd like to say on that.
Yeah, I mean, just like Martha, just like you, I get asked all the time. And it's hard to make the choice, especially if you know someone personally and then they take it personally if you say no. I try to stick with a mission of feeding and empowering women and children. So I'm involved with Meals on Wheels that feeds seniors and Girls Inc. And there was a group called Women's Initiative for Self-Employment. But I've been thinking lately about maybe starting a foundation or something like that. For me, especially being a woman of color, I really want to reach people. And one of the other opportunities I saw when I opened my restaurant was, you know, I came through restaurants not really seeing anyone who looked like me. So I really like to, you know, do that for my employees, mentor them and hire people and set that example.
Yeah, I think employment is such a huge piece of this. You know, thinking about what our employment practices look like, especially if we are moving into communities that are places where we're experiencing and directly contributing sometimes to gentrification. You know, thinking about who the people are we hiring from the community that we're moving into? What's our minimum wage? You know, who are our partners? We're actually a transitional model, so we work with one truck, we work with between 24 and 30 young people per year, but we're always looking for employer partners, people who are willing to hire young people out of our program as graduates. So thinking about employment and what employment can really do for someone in terms of them and their own future, I think is a real central part of how to give back in a really tangible way if you own or operate your own business.
We have about 250 employees, and the one thing that I'm most proud of regarding the foundation, one of my employees is here with me today, and she could tell you this herself, our foundation is run, operated, scheduled, every aspect of it is done by our employees on a volunteer basis. So as an employer, I think one of my jobs is to create opportunity for my staff, and it's opportunity that goes beyond the typical old model of a business where, you know, when you talk about opportunity in a restaurant business, so many times it's someone who comes in as a busser and gets promoted to a host and then a manager and ultimately an owner of a restaurant. I think of opportunity in a much different way. I think of it more broadly. And I think one of my obligations is to give staff the opportunity to have greater involvement in their own community as well. And most of the staff people who are involved in our foundation tell us that they have felt locked out by traditional not-for-profits. You know, they really did feel that the only thing they needed to do was write a check. And let's face it, a lot of restaurant people don't have the extra disposable income to write checks for hundreds of dollars to a not-for-profit. And this way they get to actually work the not-for-profit. And the experience to them is truly transformative.
So I'm always I like to play devil's advocate because, you know, this is all rainbows and butterflies up here, but I know that it's not necessarily. And I'd like to know about the challenges inherent in what you're doing and working in communities that aren't necessarily food hubs. I mean, you know, New York, San Francisco, LA, Chicago all have robust restaurant communities where cooks go from one restaurant to the other, and you know, ideally someone takes a job and then wants to become a chef or a floor manager. And I would imagine Jordan and Tanya and Martha, you all work with people who are necessarily looking for a job or just looking for an opportunity. And what does that mean for you and what you're doing in the long term? Does that make sense?
Because when you hire someone, you're making an investment. I look at it that way. I'm investing my time, my energy, my education. And then you have people working beside them that might be very ambitious, and you have, you know, different levels of commitment. And to get everybody on the same page and being a team, it's definitely challenging. You know, I have this one guy who, you know, in the interview he said, you know, I've been in the system, I haven't worked at all, but I really would love to try this out. I'm like, okay, I'm going to give you this opportunity, but I'm going to have really high expectations of you. And I mean, the thing about him is, you know, he doesn't know how to think big. He hasn't had the opportunity to think beyond what he's doing. So he tells me he's going to work the waffle station forever. And I'm like, that's great. Actually, I like that. But it was so funny. I have to tell this story because he's just, you know, he's working one day, he's like, chef, I figured out these waffle machines are like dictators. They dictate the pace of the line. And if you mess one up, you really mess things up. He goes, I dropped a waffle, and you looked at me like, why were you born? I said, I probably did look at you like that, didn't I? But it's just, you know, the different perspectives, I think, enrich the experience of, you know, the whole restaurant, the work. And but it definitely comes with a lot of challenges of, you know, what people expect from themselves, what you expect from them, and how you move people through.
Yeah, I think there really are, as you're getting at, there really are these tensions, you know, that exist between trying to run a social enterprise or trying to run a nonprofit organization or a foundation, and also keep in mind your bottom line for your business as well. And what I think often is the assumption is that these two things are at odds with one another, and there are real considerations. I mean, you know, a lot of the young people we work with, it's literally their first job ever. So that, you know, imagine yourself in your first job ever. But I think that, you know, what we've also been able to recognize is that you can those two things can be actually not in contrast with one another, but really actually be powerful and change the way that a business is branded. You know, I think that the quality of the product obviously needs to be of that level. We want to create return customers, but we also recognize that there is definitely this element of actual cohesion that goes along with being socially conscious and being a real business that's driving revenue. But those challenges on the day-to-day can be real, and I think one thing as someone who's been an educator, I think a lot about how we don't want to be enablers for younger people as well. You know, like if someone comes to work and they're late, you know, five times in 2 weeks, that's a real issue. It's not just a real issue for our own business, but we're also thinking about the future and that next step. And so balancing, you know, the compassion for the young people that we work with also that higher demand that you really need to raise to this level is something that I think, you know, we're thinking about and figuring out every single day. I do think that, you know, there are a lot of other social enterprises out there who have done great work, certainly before Drive Change ever came into existence. And what we've been able to do is build networks, learn from people, learn from others, get access to curriculum, share stories. And I think that that leverage of collective impact is a real thing that's out there.
You know, for years, people would come up to me and say things like, how do you get the people who work for you? As if for some reason they just dropped out of the sky and came into my restaurants and that's all there was to it. You know, just a lucky stroke of luck for me. And finally, I decided that I really needed to tell our story better. It's not, we get the same people everybody else gets. It's what we do internally with the people we get that distinguishes us. I really think our training and hiring program is extremely good, but it's beyond that. You know, Ina talked about it, hiring, knowing what your vision is, setting your expectations, and just not tolerating, you know, no one's got a gun to anyone's head if they're not happy working with you or not working to what you expect, then they've got to go find a job somewhere else. But that being said, we have very little turnover. We have tremendous buy-in from our staff regarding what the company is trying to accomplish. And Carrie asked me to work this into the conversation, so I'm doing it. I'm from Indiana, and unfortunately, our governor just passed into law a Religious Freedom Act. I don't know if any of you have been reading about it. It's been trending really high on all social media. Governor was on all the major news channels this morning trying to defend this reprehensible act that he signed into law, which basically says that any business can deny service to somebody who is gay, transgender, lesbian, or bisexual if the business owner's own religious belief believes that those things are evil.
It's worse than North Carolina.
It's worse than North Carolina. So here's my point. Why am I even bringing this up? Besides the fact that people in the hospitality business, people in restaurants, myself included, became outraged early on, and Patashu became an early outspoken opponent to this law. But what just warmed my heart was while I was on the law was enacted Friday morning, while I was on the airplane flying to New York for this event, and by the time I landed, all of my staff in all 11 restaurants had posted pictures on social media of themselves with the anti-RFRA symbols, and they were taking this message, which is incredible, and thank you. That's, but the root... I'm mentioning it because people who work for us are not robots. They're thinking, really capable humans. And when you give people the respect that they deserve, they do step up and work really diligently and hard. I truly believe that no one comes to work to do a bad job or to drop that waffle. You know, they just don't do that. And I just, you know, this law is so repulsive. And it says so many bad things about what's happening in politics of Indiana today. And the fact that my staff felt like they had the freedom to go online on Facebook to customers on our blackboards and make a political stance really is something that I really want you guys to applaud because it's a big deal. Thank you.
And, you know, that's one of the... wonderful things about restaurants and restaurant communities is that, you know, we attract all walks of life, in many cases, misfits. And we become, we all see ourselves as misfits.
We employ the unemployable. Yeah. We really do.
And it's really like a family workplace, and we depend on each other, and I think that you become incredibly supportive of one another. And I think that's across the board in what we're doing because it is hard, hard work, and you're all working toward the same goal at the end of service, which is probably having a beer or something. but I'd like to know, Jordan, is there going to be like a fleet of snow days?
That's a great question. We're the fundraisers in the house. We're actually a hybrid organization. We're a nonprofit for profit hybrid. So when thinking about your business and thinking structurally what the best decision is, we have a revenue model where a third of our annual budget comes in through the truck business itself. One third comes in through grants and foundations, and one third comes in through individual donors. But our vision for growth initially was, yeah, we're going to build a new food truck every single year. It's going to be the best new food truck every single year. Turns out that is not happening. It's really hard,
yet,
as we all know, to start small businesses, to have enough overhead capital to do both the programming work and the business work as well. So we actually have a whole nother vision for our growth in our city, which I'm really excited about. We're going to invest in the commissary space, which is like the back end space where trucks can park. We've built great relationships with other food truck businesses in the city, and there's such a high demand for credentialed employees, experienced employees, that what we're going to do is we're going to actually have them park in that commissary, pay us rent, and by parking, they're actually going to get to affiliate with Drive Change, and they'll have the opportunity, they'll be granted with the opportunity to hire young people directly from our program. So we believe that we can scale that to about between 15 and 20 trucks in New York City alone, which will allow us to work with about 150 young people per year. So we're really excited about that, and that's our vision for the next few years.
So it's clear that you all have been successful within your business of creating community and changing the people's lives who work in your business. But Tanya, can you speak to how your restaurants have been a catalyst within the community for additional change?
We just have gotten involved sort of in the politics just by being there. That's nothing I ever aspired to. But safety issues, you know, just developing relationships with the police and the mayor and, you know, making sure that, because Oakland, as people know, doesn't have the best reputation, you know, for crime and violence. And we've actually gotten more people on the street because we're in a pretty desolate industrial area. And that's just, you know, it's been great to see that influence attracting more small businesses, more minority-owned businesses, and just kind of diversity in general. I mean, I never wanted to have a small restaurant because I thought one group would take it over. I have 50 seats, and every day you walk in there, and it's just completely diverse socially, economically, persuasion, you know, everything. And, you know, that was my intention to yeah, as a person, just to have that kind of environment and to be able to see it kind of flow out to the community too. There's gentrification, but there's also retention of, you know, letting the people who are from that community stay. And a lot of it is because we employ some people who can, you know, live down the street. They live in their grandmother's house. And so, yeah, we've had a good influence there, and that's been a nice benefit.
Right, by employing people and keeping them there, it ends up strengthening the community. Because areas where we are, we deal with something that we call the brain drain, where everyone who has any opportunity leaves. Mm-hmm. And just by providing the opportunity, it's little tiny things in communities that make major differences. And you've made a huge difference in Indianapolis. Can you speak to the catalyst that you are?
No, not really. But, you know, my perspective is a little different. I think right now, I really, and I know I just talked about opportunity for staff, but I do think there are some huge ripple effects when you have, when you give staff extra opportunities. One, a couple things that we do that I'm very proud of is we have a financial literacy workshop that's open to every member of our staff, and we conduct these workshops 4 times a year, and they are heavily attended, and people who pass the workshop, I mean, let's face it, we have a lot of people who may be first generation in the United States, people who don't know how to write checks, who don't have checking accounts, don't really understand budgeting, don't understand what to do with their money, how to make their money work for them, and we talk about that in real terms. And then when someone passes the class, they are allowed to, if the occasion needs, we have a what's called a Potashew Emergency Employee Fund, Relief Fund, Peer Fund, that stands in place of when someone has an emergency that they can't get help for. So it's a big safety net, and we grant or give money to a staff member who has an emergency need as long as they have passed the financial class. That's something that I think is really important just as an employer, to think about what you can do to give back to your employees. It's, you know, that's a community too, that so often in the restaurant world where restaurateurs beat people up and have them work these outrageous hours, blah, 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 on and on and on. I really feel like we have a duty as employers to give back to our employees too. And that, the benefit to me is that it builds tremendous loyalty for what I'm doing and for my brand, and allows us the stability and continuity to do things in the community.
That is so smart and right. It's the right thing to do.
Yeah. I just want to add, too, that on that note, just like you said, investing, reinvesting in them. I'm meeting this week with a wellness coach because I realize, you know, my employees, they don't know how to take care of themselves and to have that work-life balance, and they don't think they can do it. So we're going to start incorporating that. I think it's really important. Plus, I want them to come to work, you know, and I need them to be healthy.
Does anybody have anything else they'd like to say? We've got 6 minutes.
Yes.
we're all going to fight for time up
we'll
here
start
now.
Talking about it. Absolutely. I mean, when we were just talking about community and policy and change in New York right now, you know, New York's been behind the times with this raise the age law, 16 being the age that young people are automatically arrested and treated like adults, meaning they go straight to adult facilities. If they're convicted, they leave with felonies, not juvenile adjudications. We're actually, North Carolina is unfortunately the other state. It's just New York and North Carolina that set it at 16. And there's an initiative right now at the state office to overturn that in a step-by-step process over the next few years and raise the age to 18. So that's something that we're focusing on from the political side when it comes to the business and trying to drum up support, because we really do feel that, you know, at that moment of connection with our consumer, there's this great opportunity. We all really believe that we are only as strong as our community, and we've seen that community grow and bubble and grow and bubble, and that's a very exciting thing that we just want to continue to push forward. Because, you know, one food truck is not going to change the destruction of the current criminal justice system as it exists currently right now.
Our foundation and the restaurant serves children. I mean, we are serving children from 5 to age 12. 80% of the children who attend the largest public school system in Indianapolis, Indiana, live below poverty, which is remarkable. And here we're talking about Indianapolis, which is the capital of Indiana, an agricultural state, and a state that's situated in a first world country, if not the leading first world country. And we've got 80% of the children in our community living with food insecurity. What people talking about the social justice, I used to be a prosecutor. I was an attorney in a former life. The overlapping between children who grow up in poverty, have to deal with homelessness, issues of food security, domestic violence, drug abuse, and ultimately educational issues. Somehow we're all related. We're all doing the same thing with different age groups of the same population. And, you know, I think that it's just time for companies to stand up and to not greenwash everything they do. So, for instance, I'm tired of people saying they're sustainable when all they do is offer a paper coffee cup. There's so much more to sustainability. I'm seriously, I think it's, thank you. And in that same regard, you can't say you give back to the community if you're not fully invested in giving back to the community. One of my goals in establishing both Public Greens, the restaurant, and the Potashoe Foundation was to show that you don't have to be a huge company. You don't have to be swimming in money to do this. You just have to make it a dedicated part of your life and part of the company value and say this is so important that I'm willing to take a percentage of profits and really do something impactful.
Yeah.
It's very easy for all of us to do it. It's also easy to create excuses why you can't do it. And we just decided, you know, to go to your initial question about the challenges, every challenge creates a positive opportunity. And that's how we looked at it.
Yeah, I think those are great points. And thinking about these overlaps of systems as well, and also thinking too, I think about, you know, often whenever I'm talking in front of a group of people, I think to myself, like, what do I really want to gain? If I were sitting in a seat and listening, what do I want to gain from just these conversations, you know, and make them really actionable and really tangible? One thing that I think resonated with me earlier was this idea of not taking no for an answer. Like whatever that wall is up in front of you, whatever, even if it's a bureaucratic challenge, which will be a long haul, no doubt, because of the speed in which that some of that stuff can go, recognizing that with problems come the opportunity to find solutions, I think is a really powerful lesson and something that we've learned. I mean, we, you know, took initiative and we were able to convince the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene to create a whole different kind of permit for us. There are ways to build power and build network and build flexibility into what is otherwise stoic. But I do think that as individuals and as individual consumers, there is power in where we put our money. And we all have that power. That is a real thing, that we are able to make choices when we go out to eat. We are able to make choices when we think about the experiences that we want to have. And the dollars also do end up shifting business practices as well. You see Walmart, I mean, raising their minimum wage, affecting other companies that don't pay or value their employees to raise their minimum wage. These things do have impact. So I think consumerism, you know, is something that we need to think about when it comes to how capital can actually drive socially good behavior and practices. Awesome. There's 13 seconds left. We're gonna be at Smorgasburg as an offshoot of the truck from April 4th, this upcoming weekend. See you all there through June. Just wanted to let everybody know that if you can't make it to the truck, you can come see us at the Smorgasburg markets this spring.
Cool. Thank you all very much.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.